automatic voter registration may have failed to become law in Illinois after Governor Rauner's surprise veto last year, but that doesn't mean voting right advocates have given up. Today, we talk about voting rights with the clerks of Cook and Champaign counties, David Orr and Gordy Holton. Plus, more than three decades ago, seven people in Chicago died from taking Tylenol that had been tainted with cyanide.
The Food and Drug Administration today broadened its warning to a nationwide level. We're advising consumers, says the warning, not to use extra-strength Tylenol until a series of deaths in the Chicago area can be clarified.
The FBI considers the Tylenol murders of 1982 an open and active investigation, and we have not arrested or convicted a suspect.
That's FBI agent Garrett Kroon. We'll hear about a new podcast that takes an in-depth look at what happened. And today marks our one-year anniversary of this program. To do that, the CEO of Illinois Public Media joins us. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Last year, Governor Rauner vetoed a bill that would automatically register citizens to vote when they seek state services, like getting a new driver's license, even though that bill had pretty broad bipartisan support. Now, voting rights advocates are giving it another shot. In February, lawmakers filed what they say is a simplified proposal. Tonight, Common Cause Illinois is co-sponsoring a panel at the University of Illinois to talk about this issue, particularly automatic voter registration, but also same-day registration, other voting rights issues. I'm joined on the line now by Trevor Gervais. He's a lead organizer with Common Cause Illinois, going to be a part of these discussions this evening. Trevor, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
To your mind, what do you think, how would you describe the situation with voting rights in Illinois right now? Are we doing a good job?
In a word, I would say outdated. We're not the worst in the country, but we're certainly not the best. The reality is that while we have passed really meaningful reforms like Election Day registration in recent years, we're still behind many states across the country. And by passing automatic voter registration, we can actually bring our registration system into the 21st century.
And why do you think automatic voter registration is an important part of that, Trevor?
Well, it's really simple. We don't require people to opt into other rights, and there is a right to vote here in the state of Illinois. And the reality is that we have, within state databases, we can tell who is eligible to vote and who is not. And all that this would change is instead of having to opt into the right to vote, you'd have the opportunity to opt out. Only eligible voters would be automatically registered to vote. This would make our list significantly more secure. It saves taxpayer money and could even shorten lines on Election Day.
Now, there have always been sort of questions with automatic voter registration, with all of these implementations, how counties are able to afford doing that. What's your response to that, especially given the state budget crisis that we're in?
Well, here's what's really interesting. Maricopa County, which is out in Arizona, actually recently did a study looking at the difference in cost of registering someone to vote by paper and registering someone to vote online or through an automatic voter registration type system. They found that it cost almost a dollar per registrant if you're using paper, but it costs pennies if you're using an electronic system. And so while there might be some upfront cost to actually modernize our infrastructure, this could absolutely save money in the long term.
That's Trevor Gervais with Common Cause Illinois. By the way, if you were in Central Illinois, we'll tweet out that link to that conversation about that's happening this evening. If you want to attend, one of the other folks who's going to be there is Gordy Holton. He's Champaign County Clerk, one of the gentlemen in charge of implementing this across Illinois. He's in studio with me. Gordy, welcome to the 21st. Back to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And on the line from Chicago, Cook County Clerk David Orr. David, welcome back to the 21st. It's good to have you with me as well.
You bet.
Gordy, you're on this panel discussion tonight at U of I, along with Democratic State Representative Carol Ammons, a couple of other folks. What are your thoughts about automatic voter registration? Do you think that's a good idea?
As the Champaign County Clerk, I've supported the concept for a while. This is not a new thing nationally or in the state of Illinois, especially in the wake of the Election Day registration mandates, which were passed several years ago in the state of Illinois. Automatic voter registration makes a lot of sense because Election Day registration is such an inefficient, cumbersome process for voters and for election authorities. Automatic voter registration sort of streamlines that and makes it more efficient.
David, it's been almost a year. It was last August when Governor Rauner vetoed the automatic voter registration bill. I know, remember conversations we had with you on the program after how disappointed you were by that veto. What do you think the effect was on this past election season?
Well, it created lots of problems. Let's put it like this. AVR is the most important thing that we could do right now, at least for those of us who run elections. We need it as soon as possible. Again, you have to understand, thousands and thousands of citizens, just look for example, thousands of people registered before the presidential election. Many of them may not even vote again until 2018 or 2020, okay? But many thousands of those people will move. And if we have AVR, we can keep all of that record keeping. We can keep the list accurate because when they move from Chicago to Gordy's county, they can automatically be re-registered. That, number one, is enormously efficiency. You know, your guest before was saying that there's a difference to about 95 cents to 5 cents. Okay, there's a big savings. And just as important, and particularly for all people that are concerned about fair elections and integrity in elections, the worst thing you can have is when people are voting from address they no longer live at. And that is what's happening too often in Illinois, and that is what I want to stop.
Why is that the worst thing that you could have, David?
Well, I mean, for one, the worst would be is denying people the right to vote, okay? But in our present situation, what's so bad about that is those of us are concerned about making sure we have integrity in elections. If you have lots of people that are no longer there, which we do in many cases, okay, that means those who might want to cheat can step in and easily figure out that so-and-so doesn't live there. Now, we had something 2 years ago, which we raised a lot of hell about. Unfortunately, the state's attorney who was defeated last November did nothing for 2 years on this case. The new state's attorney has indicted someone, and I think there'll be others. That particular scheme was to try and misuse absentee balloting. With good work, we were able to stop it. But the difficulty now is if you have lists that aren't clean, you're like inviting the opportunity. Now, of course, we don't have massive fraud like the president has talked about, but the fact is all of us, Republican, Democrat, want to make it very difficult for those who want to cheat. And being someone who's elected official in Chicago and Cook County region, I know there are people that try and cheat. And it's ridiculous when we have the technical ability to do it, simply the political will, and besides to have Republicans not supporting this. Now, fortunately, Gordy's a good guy. But we need everybody to support this. The governor signed it. So we make it more difficult for anybody that might want to cheat.
Gordy, I wonder what your response is to the simplified proposal that lawmakers have put forth, or that what they're saying is a simplified proposal. Do you have a sense of that's something that you would also support?
Well, the language that I was looking at this morning it makes some changes in response to some requests by the governor's negotiators. This is a work in progress. The things that we're haggling about at this point, I think, are really technical details in the implementation. Which agencies are included? How is the data going to move from the agencies to the State Board of Elections to us? Who makes the final determination of whether or not somebody's a registered voter and they get put on the voter rolls? Those sorts of things, I think, are not insurmountable obstacles, and I'm hopeful we can all get on the same page and get this thing moved.
And, Gordy, to your mind, is this, as you're listening to what David Orr is saying, is this generally a bipartisan issue in Illinois, automatic voter registration?
The bill passed last year with some bipartisan support. I'm obviously a downstate Republican county clerk. There are a handful of my colleagues who are downstate Republicans who are supporting this bill. Primarily, because we do see some advantages in the efficiencies and the integrities of the list. To me, the fact that we have Election Day registration in Illinois, which means anyone can show up and register and vote on Election Day, is obviously a huge challenge for us in Champaign County with our transient population. It also opens the door to potential voter fraud. Let's get those people on the rolls ahead of time using automatic voter registration. Let's make sure their address is up to date. And then the citizens and the political parties and the candidates who are interested in checking those things, as well as our office, can make sure that the lists have the highest level of integrity.
And how would you say things went this year? Of course, in Champaign County, there is the University of Illinois. There's a very transient population, not just with faculty, but obviously with the tens of thousands of students that are going back and forth. How would you say things went this past election season?
I think they went not particularly well in the primary election, but very well for the November election, in part because we asked for and got about a 20% increase to our elections budget from our county board. Necessitated by the fact that we have Election Day registration. Election Day registration is a slow, inefficient process. It causes long lines, and we have huge concentrations of voters demanding Election Day registration on our campus. So we had to staff those voting locations with 13, 15, 17 election judges, extra laptops, extra equipment, larger rooms, and all of that cost us between $150,000 and $200,000 more for November's election.
David Orr, what's your response to counties unlike, you know, Champaign and Cook counties have pretty large property tax bases that can perhaps cover some of these costs. What's your response to other counties, given the state budget impasse and the lack of funding that lots of counties have seen to cover the legislation that already exists that has to be implemented?
First, if I might, I think that some of the things that Gordy said were really right on, so I want to mention that. I also want to point out we did not have those kind of problems with Election Day registration. Remember, we're bigger.
In Cook County.
We have more resources. In Cook County, it actually worked very well. People stayed in the same line. We did have to put some extra staff. So anyway, it worked well. I just wanted to say that. In terms of the cost, the bottom line is Illinois is a rich state. We just have bad politics. Illinois could have plenty of money. These are political decisions. The amount of money that my colleagues, particularly downstate, need is not substantial. Okay, it's all doable. So again, I feel bad for many of them that don't have the ability to do some of the technical upgrades that we'd like. But that is all going to come. And I think if we get a compromise, as Gordy talked about on this bill, then I think it'll be easier to work on other compromises. But Illinois is not a broke state. They just have not taken the political will to work out a compromise. So I do think these can be overcome, but we certainly don't want to sacrifice any voting rights while Illinois struggles over its political budget.
That's Cook County Clerk David Orr. Champaign County Clerk Gordy Hilton is in studio with me, online with us as well as Trevor Gervais, who's a lead organizer with Common Cause, Illinois. Trevor, as you're listening to this conversation, I wonder if you think that state lawmakers have made voting rights a priority. If that's something, I know, you know, it's something, it's interesting to have this conversation now. We tend to talk about voting rights around election time, but immediately before or after an election. This is, you know, we've just finished some municipal elections, but this is kind of a quiet season in terms of voting. Do you think that we prioritize voting rights enough? The lawmakers prioritize voting rights enough in this state?
I mean, I think that voting rights can always be more of a priority, but I'm proud of the number of people who have come out in favor of automatic voter registration and the folks that have continued to work on it after the election. You know, when you look at the last iteration of this bill, which passed last year, it wasn't a couple Democrats and a couple Republicans. It was almost all Democrats and 29 Republicans. And so it was substantial bipartisan support. And so I think we're really encouraged by that. Of course, it was frustrating when the governor vetoed it, but what's exciting is that everyone is back at the table. We're having these conversations, and it's clear that this is what the voters want. And so hopefully state legislators and the governor will acknowledge that and make sure that we get something passed in time for the next election.
Trevor, are you in conversation with Governor Rauner's office about this? Is there a concern that this would be vetoed yet again? Certainly, it was a somewhat surprising veto that happened last year, given the amount of bipartisan support the bill had.
Yeah, our coalition, which is the Just Democracy Coalition, has continued to have conversations with Democrats and Republicans and the governor's office to make sure that we're doing everything possible to get everyone on board. Obviously, the best case scenario is to make sure that this passes as soon as possible. And frankly, election authorities need a little bit of time to make sure that they can get this up and running. And so not only do we want it to get passed this month, but we also want to make sure that the governor signs it quickly. And so we're having those conversations.
David, or as someone who's been a huge proponent of automatic voter registration, this has been a really important issue for you. I wonder what you are doing, what conversations you're having with Chicago lawmakers about this now to also get this bill passed.
Well, I think we're all doing the same things. You know, what the Just Democracy Coalition is doing, what Gordy is doing with other clerks and legislators. We are talking to not just, of course, Chicago area. We're talking to people throughout the state. A lot of our work works through the leadership. That's often the way we work. And because often the way it works in Illinois is the leaders try and get as clear a signal as possible what their voters will tolerate, not their voters, but those on their side, either Democrat or Republican. So there's, as was mentioned earlier, there's daily conversations. There is hope for a good piece of legislation here. There, as Gordy said, you know, there's some things that we would love that maybe we'd be a little softer on. We certainly would like it if all the agencies were involved. That would help a lot. One of the things that's still critical, of course, is the timing of this. And, of course, we want it for all the reasons I mentioned as soon as possible, and there's some debate about that. But the good news is people are talking to each other, so I am going to remain hopeful at the moment.
Gordy, what's the goal of your conversation this evening? What are you hoping folks get out of this conversation?
I'm hoping they perhaps get a little better understanding of the implementation issues surrounding something like AVR, that it's not necessarily as simple as the legislature
check a box,
passing
right? A, everyone thinks you just check a box.
Right. The governor signs a bill and all of a sudden all these people are magically added to our rolls. There's software updates that have to be made both at the State Board of Elections to push the data to us. And then every election authority in the state operates their own independent voter registration system. So we all have to be able to accept that information. We have to, in a literal sense, add those people to the rolls, mail them voter cards, confirm their addresses. So this is not something that is a 30-day or a 60-day implementation window.
In an ideal world, how much time would you like to have as a clerk to prepare for something like this?
I think the original bill had an implementation deadline of the summer of 2018 to try and put these folks on the rolls for the November election. I think the State Board of Elections, for one, has enormous concerns about their ability, given they have no budget, to meet that implementation deadline.
That's Gordy Halton. He's a clerk of Champaign County. Again, this evening, a panel co-sponsored by Common Cause Illinois at the University of Illinois. We'll tweet out all the details for those of you who are in the area and want to attend that. I want to thank Gordy Halton for taking time to be with me, along with David Orr, clerk of Cook County. Gentlemen, thanks for being with me. Always a pleasure to speak with both
thank
of you.
You.
Thank you.
Thanks, and thanks also to Trevor Gervais from Common Cause Illinois. Again, we'll tweet all of that out. If you follow 21st Show, 21ST Show, we'll also throw it up at our website, 21stshow.org. Thanks, Trevor. Stay tuned. The 21st is next. Continues next. Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo.
The Food and Drug Administration today broadened its warning to a nationwide level. We're advising consumers, says the warning, not to use extra-strength Tylenol until a series of deaths in the Chicago area can be clarified.
The phone has been ringing off the hook at Rush Presbyterian St. Luke's Medical Center in Chicago.
We've been receiving calls about once every 15 seconds. At the Rush Presbyterian St. Luke's, we only have three poison lines, and they're lit up constantly ever since yesterday morning.
That was more than three decades ago in Chicago. Seven people mysteriously died in what was later found out to be poisoning from Tylenol that had been laced with cyanide. Despite all the media coverage it received at the time, the incident today is not often remembered. But a new podcast about drugs and medicine produced by KERA with support from NPR tells the full story. We're joined now by one of the co-hosts of that podcast. Lauren Silverman is a health, science, and technology reporter with KERA News in Dallas. Hi, Lauren. Welcome to the 20 First. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Lauren, why did you guys decide to focus on the story of Tylenol cyanide poisoning that happened mostly in Chicago, which was interesting for me because I kind of vaguely remembered this as a kid, but I didn't even know that it happened here in Illinois.
Yeah. Well, at the time, it became a national, even an international story. But really, in this podcast, what we want to do is answer a pretty simple question, which is, what's in your medicine cabinet? So what is the story behind the pills in there? And a lot of us inside our medicine cabinets have Tylenol. And there's this really crazy story behind Tylenol that most of us, especially who are younger, don't really know or maybe have only vaguely heard about. And it was one of the first cases, some people say, of domestic terrorism in the U.S. And it reshaped the way we take pills today, the way all of us take pills.
So before we get to that, let's talk about the story. You all opened the podcast, and it's such a heartbreaking explanation about a newlywed couple who dies suddenly in their home. What happened?
Yeah, it's really a sad, sad story. And what started everything off was the death of a 12-year-old girl, actually, Mary Kellerman, who went into her bathroom to take some Tylenol because she was staying home from school one day. She had felt sick and she collapsed in there. Her father found her and she was dead. And there were a number of these cases happening in and around Chicago that same day. But it seemed random. There was nothing linking them together, and it wasn't that suspicious until three people all in the same house collapsed. And these three people were – two was a young couple who'd recently been married and a brother. And first what happened was that one of the brothers, Adam, who was a postal worker, he dropped and collapsed dead in his house. And all of the family – this is a big Polish family, so they're all getting together for the funeral there, gathering. And his brother, Stanley, and his new wife, Teresa, were also at the house in mourning. While they were there, they didn't feel so well, and they decided to take some Tylenol. And they happened to take Tylenol from the same bottle that Stanley, who had died earlier that day, had taken it from. And both of them suddenly collapsed and were taken – well, one was pronounced dead. Stanley was pronounced dead, and Teresa was taken to the hospital. So it seems suspicious that three people all collapsed same day, and they couldn't figure out why. They were all young and
healthy. Right, young, healthy people. And so it is fascinating. You all go back into – in this podcast – you go into – you talk to the former medical examiner. How did they – how did he make the connection, and how did he come to the idea that all of these people had died from cyanide poisoning?
Yeah. At first, he didn't know what was going on, and he wasn't even supposed to be at work when he heard about this. But he started to come up with possible ideas. First, he investigated different types of poisonings, but one of the types of poisonings that could do something like this, besides carbon monoxide, was cyanide. And he knew that cyanide has a particular smell, which I had no idea about this. But Sima Yasmin, the co-host, she was familiar with this because she's actually a doctor. But cyanide has a smell. And so while there were some investigators on the scene in the houses where people had dropped dead, Donahue, who is the medical examiner, he asks one of the investigators over the phone to smell the bottle of Tylenol. And he smells it, and he can smell something that's sort of like bitter almonds. And that's the smell of cyanide. So he knew then he had a lead, and he started looking in their bodies for the traces of cyanide and was able to find that.
And so this leads to – we were playing some of the media clips from this. At the time, this was probably one of the biggest stories of 1982 when this happens, right? Like, this becomes an international story. It leads to an unprecedented Mayor Jane Byrne at the time. Does she actually ban Tylenol from Chicago? Everybody, what happens?
Yeah. I mean, imagine it. This is something that is in everyone's medicine cabinets, and it's something that people trust so much. So the very thought that a pill you turn to for a headache could kill you was terrifying. And beyond that, no one knew if it was in other products, if it was in something in the fridge, if it was in something on other aisles in the stores. So there was so much panic and so much fear that Mayor Jane Byrne was put in this position where she wasn't sure, of course, what to do. And she ended up banning Tylenol in the city, and there were police with their sirens on going throughout the city, warning people not to take Tylenol, telling them to throw away or turn in any bottles of Tylenol. So it was a really extreme case.
And so it ends up, and I know there's this great detail in the podcast about how they're printing pamphlets in all these different languages and distributing them all over Chicago saying, don't take Tylenol. This leads to a recall of 31 million bottles of Tylenol. And it also led to some pretty major changes in the FDA in the way pills are packaged, right?
Yeah. A little bit later, there was a law that was passed, the Anti-Tampering Act, and that made it a federal crime to actually tamper with medicine. It wasn't a federal crime beforehand because nothing like this had ever happened, so it didn't occur to them. It also made it so that pharmaceutical companies needed to package things like this over the counter in blister packs or with safety seals so that it would prevent people from tampering with medication.
And I imagine this was for Johnson & Johnson, the parent company of Tylenol, this is sort of a complete, I don't want to say it is a complete PR disaster, right? I mean, in terms of having a product that's, as you said, everyone sees as a safety, as a first aid, as something that helps you, turns out to be so harmful. How did they handle all of this?
Well, what's funny is that marketing experts predicted that Tylenol would be the doom of Johnson & Johnson, that it would spell disaster, that they wouldn't be able to recover. At the time, they relied on sales of Tylenol. I think that they had one of every $5 that the company was making came from selling Tylenol, and it had 37% of the market share for over-the-counter painkillers. So once the news of these cyanide-laced pills got out, that flipped. The company's market share dropped from 37% to 7%. So they had to come up with a public relations campaign to convince people to trust Tylenol again. And they did this very effectively, in large part by acting quickly to come up with commercials and ads that built trust in the company. So they had people like firefighters saying why they still took Tylenol, people who were mothers saying why they still took Tylenol, these sort of testimonials to get people back on board with the company. And they were able to turn the image around. And as you hear when my co-host Seema Yasmin asks young people today what they think of when they think of Tylenol, most people don't say cyanide.
We're going to play a little bit of that. Let's take a listen to that now.
I went to George Washington University in D.C. just to chat to the students on campus and find out what they knew or didn't know.
What comes to mind when you think of Tylenol?
Relief. Pain relief.
I guess just like fever reducer, pain reliever.
Headaches.
Just painkiller.
Minor.
Fever and like muscle problems. Weakness.
Relief. Pain relief.
Think of it as being safe?
Yes.
Does cyanide come to mind when you think of Tylenol?
Not really. No.
Would you ever think of cyanide when you think of Tylenol?
No, and I don't even know what cyanide is.
Does cyanide come to mind?
Oh my God, no, it doesn't, but now it will.
And then the other part of this, Lauren, I'm not sure how old you are, but the other kind of incident that I have this sort of vague memory as a kid of remembering this. But also the big thing I remember is Halloween candy. And I remember as a child, my parents saying that they had to like check all of my Halloween candy before we ate it. And I have like this very clear memory of my dad like spreading out all the candy, you know, sort of like your ritual, right? My sisters and I would like sort the candy because then we would start trading the candy. Right. And then we'd like, but before we commenced trading and all of that other stuff, my dad would have to check the candy. And I remember I have this vague memory of it being because of this.
Yeah. So I had no idea that there were this many copycat cases. There were something like 270 confirmed copycat cases that the U.S. Food and Drug Administration reported. And these were pills tainted with everything from rat poison to hydrochloric acid. So there was also, though, copycats, like you're saying, who decided to tamper with food, hot dogs, Halloween candy. And it's something that still echoes today in Halloween's of modern times.
Yeah, yeah. And so I guess part of this is also the thing that was also very surprising to me about this was you all were able to, you know, we were talking about Teresa, who was one of the three family members who died. You were actually able to speak to her brother about everything. I imagine because it's been three decades, maybe he was more willing to talk about what had happened.
Yeah. You know, what's funny is when I first spoke to him, he was hesitant to talk about it, which I can only imagine why. Most of the family members of victims of this don't want to talk about it, and they're tired of having people call them on anniversaries of the murders and asking them what's happened since. But I told him we weren't just going to do an anniversary piece. We really wanted to look at how this reshaped pills and medicine and also talk about the case study that Johnson & Johnson has become in terms of this model for how a corporation should handle public relations crises. And that's what the 1982 Tylenol murders has become. It's become a case study for business school students. And that bothers people like Bob, people like Bob Tarasevich, because they don't feel like Johnson & Johnson behaved as well as everyone seems to in the rest of the country. He sees it as, in some ways, a failure on their part.
Right. And there's all these kind of conspiracy theories about, was it someone who did this in the store? Was this something that happened in the factory? Was this something that was Johnson & Johnson's fault? And I wanted to play another portion of the podcast where you and co-host Sina Yasmin talk about how these murders are still unsolved.
The FBI considers the Tylenol murders of 1982 an open and active investigation, and we have not arrested or convicted a suspect for this crime.
That's Garrett Kroon, an FBI agent in Chicago, who says, make no mistake, they have not solved this case yet.
Motives were explored. People were explored. Sightings were explored.
And this is the former prosecutor, Jeremy Margolis, who said it's not that they weren't working tirelessly to pursue every lead.
Lookalikes, photographs, musings of people who would call in on hotlines were explored.
But everything fizzled out.
That's a piece from a podcast we're talking about right now. It's about the Tylenol murders. Co-host Lauren Silverman from KERA in Dallas is with me on the line right now. So the Illinois police are still actively working on this, Lauren?
Yes, they're the ones who are on the case, although I don't know how actively they're
actually
working on
it. It's still open, right? It's
still open. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And because it's still open, it means that no one in the public can access any of the files related to the investigation. And that's one of the big complaints some of the family members of the victims, because they want to see, well, what actually happened in this investigation, and how do you know it was really some madman who went into stores and took down bottles of Tylenol and put capsules filled with cyanide back in those bottles, and that's really what happened?
Yeah, and that's why we have all of those anti-tampering, like the foil labels and all of that stuff. That's why that all exists today, right?
Exactly. It's all a result of the 1982 Tylenol murders. And I was thinking about it, and I can't think of that many products that were shaped by murder. I always think of products that have been shaped to prevent accidents, which is what I originally thought safety seals were to prevent accidents. But the story behind it is much more grim, and something that some people are reminded of every time they open up a bottle of Tylenol.
Right. Yeah, especially for these families. Well, if you want to hear more about this, you can check out this new podcast. It's about drugs and medicine. Not yet named, right, Lauren? But we will tweet out the link to it, and so everyone can see it. We found it on NPR One. We will send out that link to everyone if you follow our handle, 21st Show. We'll also put it up at our website at 21stshow.org. But I really want to thank Lauren Silverman, who is a health science and technology reporter and one of the co-hosts of this new podcast about drugs. She's with KERA News in Dallas. Hey, Lauren, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us about all of this.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. I have been saying those words to Daily Audience for exactly a year today. And this week, as we celebrate our one-year anniversary of The 21st being live on the air every day, we're going to take a few minutes each day to look back on the past year and check in with each of our partner stations across the state. Because today is our actual anniversary, I wanted to talk to Moss Bresnahan. He's the CEO of Illinois Public Media. He's in our Urbana studio with me. He's also also, by the way, the CEO of WTVP in Peoria, Moss. Welcome to the 21st.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
It's fun to have you here sitting in the studio talking. You and I don't normally have a conversation like this on air.
I'm usually down the hall listening at this time.
You are, and you're a great listener of the show, and you are also the person behind making this show happen. So I wanted to start by asking, what was your sense for why you wanted to create the 21st? What did you want to accomplish with it?
Well, I'm a voracious consumer of public media, so I listen all the time, I watch all the time, and I love the mission of it. So, you know, using the power of public media to advance education and culture and good citizenship is something that that I love, and I'm in this privileged position to be able to create and shape programs. And, you know, I don't think there's ever been a time when public media has been more important. When you look around the country and you find the very best public media outlets, they're the operations that have not only the best from NPR or national programs, but also have the very best and high-quality local programs. I think that that combination of really great NPR programming and really great local programming is just a great competitive advantage. You can't beat it.
That said, you were actually just in Washington recently. You were speaking to the entire Illinois congressional delegation about the importance of public media. Before I ask you what you said to them, I'm curious what they said to you.
Well, I was actually gratified that they're all very supportive. I think that they all recognize the value of public media. They all recognize that their constituents like it. They recognize that it's really not a partisan issue. And they all express their support. I mean,
On a bipartisan basis,
that's right. You know, even in Peoria, Representative Darren LaHood, he used to come in and answer phones during our pledge drives. And so he knows the operation. He knows the value of it. He knows that people love the local station. And so, you know, they all expressed some caution that these times are unpredictable and public media could get wrapped up in some big omnibus bill. But if it ever came to an up or down vote, I feel pretty confident that our local delegation would support public media. And that's because people did call. When the threat came, when the president's skinny budget came out, people did respond. And so very grateful to our listeners and viewers for calling their local congressional delegation.
Yeah. What's the importance of public media?
Well, you know, the message varies somewhat, but certainly education is still at the heart of what we do. It's in our DNA. So I think people recognize that public media stands alone in the fact that it's focused on public service, you know, that we have diverse voices. That's still unique, and it's highly valued. And so I think nobody would want to see that go away.
You know, you mentioned diverse voices. I asked you before we had this conversation on air to pick something from the past year that you really liked or remembered from the 21st. And you actually picked a conversation we had. We did two different shows last summer from Danville, actually, from the Boys and Girls Club. And before we talk about why you picked it, let's play a portion of that and hear that.
Hi, my name is Kuvazine. I want to be a hairstylist and a photographer.
Hi, my name is Dejanay, and I want to be a kindergarten teacher to help other kids get a good education and for them to grow up and try to do something they like and want to be and follow their dreams.
Hi, my name is Sally, and I want to be an actor and a fashion designer.
Hi, my name is Jeremiah, and I want to go to the NBA.
I think the American dream is to have equal rights and be able to do anything.
Following your dreams and being able to do what you want to do.
Things are changing because, like, a whole bunch of people are not getting education and going to school. A lot of people are getting poor because they don't have education, which they need to go to school for education and get a degree in college. That's what I think.
Those are some kids from the Danville Boys and Girls Club that I spoke with last summer. It was part of a whole series we were doing, Moss, Redream. It was a partnership. I'm speaking with Moss Bresnahan, who's the CEO of Illinois Public Media. I know you're a very faithful listener to the 21st, so I know you've listened to lots of conversations that we've had. Why did you want to highlight that one in particular?
Well, there were so many. It's really tough to pick just one. But I thought, you know, what a great question to ask kids. What's your dream? And it made me think about, what does the American dream even mean anymore? And, you know, are we doing enough to make the American dream available, kids? And it was delightful to hear these kids, some of them 7, 8 years old, talk about their dreams. And there was one point where a little girl did an original rap, which was really sweet. But then, you know, in the course of the program, there was the other end of the spectrum where a father talked about how he lost his son in a random gang shooting. So to be reminded of, you know, the fact that the American dream means so many different things to so many people, that We all have to work hard to get there, but it's tougher for a lot of kids. And I think that's something we should all be more aware of and think more about what we can do to help them achieve their dream.
You know, you're in a unique position because you are here at WILL at Illinois Public Media in Champaign-Urbana. You also are the CEO of WTVP in Peoria. And so you, I think, are in a unique position of already being connected to two different communities across central Illinois. Why do you think it's important for people in these areas to be connected to each other, to be united in conversations about the state? Because I think we do tend to have either national conversations or local conversations and not as many state conversations.
Well, that's very true. And I think, you know, this state is divided up into so many different media markets that, you know, you get your Chicago media and that's it. Or if you're in Champaign-Urbana, you're really focused on just the local outlets. And I think it's important for the state to be connected and to have a chance to talk to itself as a state. There should be opportunities for Chicago and the Quad Cities and Peoria and Champaign-Urbana to talk together. And so I think that's one of the important roles that the 21st can play. And, you know, that sort of bubble that we live in geographically is one of many divisions that exist, right, between haves and have-nots or Fox viewers versus MSNBC viewers. And I think it's a very important role for public media to play to bridge those divides. I do think that public media is one of the few places where we do overlap, you know, where people can hear local news and where we can expose people who might normally live in a bubble to opinions and viewpoints that are outside the bubble. And I think that's something that you've done very well over this year.
I know that this is an issue that you care very deeply about, getting people out of their bubbles. And I wonder, as the head of IPM and as someone who lives in the Champaign-Urbana area, what are the issues that matter most to you? What are things that you think are really important for this area as well as for you personally?
Mm-hmm. Well, I really enjoyed your programs in public policy and politics. I think that there's, you know, the live remote you did from the State House prior to the governor's budget address.
You
broadcast live from the State House. And for me, it was unique in that it wasn't focused on the conflict or who to blame. It was really good, deep analysis from both sides. It wasn't partisan hacks shouting at each other. It was good analysis from different perspectives, different vantage points. And you also have had on, you know, people who are impacted by it, both social service agencies, but the people who receive those services. So I love that because, you know, we need to do more to understand that. I think this is a little bit sort of inside, but, you know, the program is about the university. Because this is a fascinating place. And so when you have a researcher on or an investigator, like I love the conversation you did with Gene Robinson on the endangered bumblebees.
The rusty-patched bumblebee.
Yeah, I learned a lot from him. And it's great that he's just right down the street, a world-renowned expert. I think also when you have on the chancellor or, you know, President Tim Killeen, it's really insightful for me to learn more about what's happening here and how we're impacted by the budget stalemate. Because it's a local issue, but it has regional implications, and there's just not enough of that.
Right, and when you think about the University of Illinois system across three campuses across the state, and President Killeen here, as it's even its role, just even if you just think just straight as an employer in across the state of Illinois, it has a huge impact.
A huge impact on the students here, their families, but also the economy. I mean, this is a great engine for the economic development in this state, and so it's just. So much of the coverage of the impact of the state budget crisis is so minimal. It's just sound bites. And so when I have the opportunity to hear President Killeen come on or the chancellor or someone, and it's really illuminating and unique. I also, you know, I love arts and culture, and you've had a lot of great guests on, whether it's the Jupiter Quartet or the Mark Morris Dance Group or the Poets of Illinois. You know, those are, I think it's really important for public media to keep the arts on the air, to support it and to encourage others to support it. And so I think those are very important programs that you've done too.
Well, Moss Bresnahan is the CEO of Illinois Public Media. He's the guy behind the 21st and the whole inception of all of this. So I wanted to introduce him to our audience. You're someone who people don't get to talk to. I get to talk to you all the time, but our audience doesn't get to hear from you. So, Moss, I appreciate you taking the time to speak with us.
Well, thank you, Nyla. Illinois is very lucky to have you, and we look forward to another year of great programs.
Thanks. As we celebrate our anniversary, we're also having conversations with the people behind the scenes who make this show possible every day. I read their name in the credits, so you don't get to hear them very much on air. One of those names is Christine Herman. She's a producer with the show. She's actually the producer who's been with the show the longest, and she's here with me in studio now. Hi, Christine.
Hi, Nyla.
Maybe you can describe what you do as a producer for the show, because everyone always thinks it's just me.
Sure.
And I'm like, nope, there's a whole team of people behind me.
Yeah, I had no idea what a producer did until I became one. I come up with ideas for things we can talk about on the show. I reach out to possible guests. I pre-interview them, so I talk to them before they come on the air. I kind of help them understand what it is we want to talk to them about. And then I write up questions and an introduction that you can read on the air to introduce the topic. We have all sorts of conversations in the office about how we're going to frame this conversation and how we want to get people to join the conversation.
Right. There's a lot of writing and rewriting mm-hmm. of the questions and the introductions, all of that.
Yeah.
And research. You do a lot of research as
yeah.
well.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. You kind of have to become an instant expert on different topics since we're live every day and there's new topics on every show. I'm constantly reading stuff, prior news coverage and other background information about the different topics we discuss.
Everyone always asks me this. They say, where do you come up with the ideas for the segments you do on the show?
I'm always paying attention to social media, what people are tweeting about and discussing on Facebook, the latest news. And, you know, if there's something going on nationally, how can we have a conversation about this topic and how it's affecting Illinois? What's the Illinois angle to this topic? So those are common approaches. And then we get tons of emails from people who are giving us ideas for things we could talk about as
well. Right. And as we say that, you can always email us with your ideas. The email is talk@21stshow.org. We've had a lot of conversations and segments that you've produced over the past year.
Yeah.
Christine, what stands out to you?
I think one of the most memorable segments was we talked about suicide stigma, and it was actually someone who is based in Illinois whose sister had died of suicide, and the family wanted to be very public about how she died because they wanted to take away the stigma around suicide and just have it be something that there are more conversations about so that we could address that. So we had her come on the show along with two other people who had family members die of suicide. And it was just this really powerful, you know, obviously very difficult conversation, but an important one to have. We also do a lot of fun things on the show. I took my audio recorder and went to a 3D printing workshop for girls, and it was geared towards like elementary school girls to get them interested in science and engineering, and I put together a little audio story for that, and we talked with the founder of that on the show. And then we've also talked about issues that affect education. There was a report about a teacher shortage nationwide, and there was a professor at Bradley University who joined us to talk about the report and why are teachers leaving the profession. But for that conversation, I also reached out to current and former teachers from all across Illinois, from both urban and rural areas, to join the conversation. And we had people call in and join us in studio and via social media as well. And here's some audio from that segment that aired last fall.
Working with the kids obviously is one of the more enjoyable things. Leaving was kind of a tough decision, but it was kind of one of those decisions I think I had to make.
If you're not interested in moving into administration, there can be a bit of a ceiling for teachers who would like to pursue leadership opportunities.
We got a Facebook comment from Charlene. She says, top-down curricula driven mostly by standardized testing simply sucks all the joy out of a profession, which in my experience is one of the most creative and satisfying careers out there.
Yeah, and that day on the show, we also had reached out to superintendents of school districts about what they were struggling with to recruit and retain teachers. So I just feel like our show is a really great platform to exploring all sorts of conversations and going in depth and bringing in people to be a part of that conversation.
What are you working on next?
We've got a series that we're going to be talking about how the opioid crisis has been affecting what that has looked like in Illinois, and especially how issues regarding the state budget and the lack of a state budget has been affecting social service agencies' ability to help some of these communities.
That's Christine Herman. She is one of the forces behind the 21st, even though it's a voice you don't hear on air every day. As we celebrate our one-year anniversary, today is our actual one-year anniversary of being on the air daily. I want to thank Christine and all of the folks who are behind this, and I want to thank you, the audience, for tuning in. I really appreciate that you all, I say thanks for listening every day, and I mean that from the bottom of my heart. So thanks to all of you for listening. Thanks to everyone who works on this show every day. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Have a great day.